Hare Krishna. Welcome. Happy Father's Day for all of you fathers out there. Unknowingly, I think I picked a subject that fits in nicely with fatherhood. My talk today is entitled Dharma, Personal versus Professional. This is going to cover two of my favorite subjects, Dharma and leadership. Never get tired of talking about those two things. In the scriptures, Vedic scriptures, Mahabharata, Ramayana, the Bhagavat, Srimad Bhagavatam, those three, that's what we will focus on today and take our lessons, hopefully, from there. The Bhagavatam, of course, is a prequel to the Mahabharata, and it tells us the story of Krishna's early life in Gokul. These three shastras or scriptures deal with every possible or conceivable family issue. Intergenerational conflict, succession planning, and sibling rivalry. The situations in those shastras inform us with thoughts and ideas of timeless wisdom, which are just as applicable today as they were thousands of years ago. They teach us how to manage personal, family, and professional relationships, which we all pretty much are faced with on a daily basis. When do we need to manage those things? When we're faced with situations that are dharma sankat, ethical dilemmas. What is the right conduct or path of action in this circumstance? Prabhupada has taught us desha kala patra. Time, place, and circumstance. Whatever principles you're trying to apply, such as dharma, ethics, morals, whatever, we always have to consider time, place, and circumstance. Do we have to make adjustments? I dare say we do. Otherwise, we're not paying attention. So, firstly, the definition of family. What is the definition of a family? Even now, you know, from back then, when those shastras were recorded, to now, the definition of a family has morphed and changed considerably. But let's look at it from back then. Strictly speaking, none of the families in those stories in the shastras are defined by blood. Ram and Lakshman in the Ramayana are half-brothers. They have a common father, but a different mother. The five Pandava brothers, three of them have a common mother, none have a common father. Krishna is given away to a foster family at birth, right? Yashoda, Nanda. And Baladev, his half-brother, is from a different mother, same father. So therefore, with that in mind, does blood, law, or custom define a family necessarily? No. What really defines a family? Is it not mutual respect, trust, and love? That's what defines a family. That's what defines a bond. That's what defines a kinship. We all have friends with whom we are closer than we are to our own family members. Do we not? We all do. We've all experienced this, I think. If there is no mutual respect, trust, and love within that structure, then the codes of behavior or the rules become what? are meaningless. What good are the rules if we don't have any mutual respect? Right? And in that vacuum, what comes in? What rushes in like the wind in the Wicklow Mountains? Mistrust, power, and control take over. Such as in the case of the Kauravas in the Mahabharata, and our great villain, Ravana, in the Ramayana. Application of rules. How do we apply rules? Rules are the building blocks of every institution. Without rules, you cannot have an institution. We have to know what the boundaries are. We have to know what the expectations are. We have to understand the guidelines. The members who agree to go along with the rules are, by analogy, the sheep. The sheep all agree to go along. Not a problem. Oh, we're this way? Oh, we're going this way. Okay. And the independent guy who challenges the rules, well, he's the goat. Or the free thinker. Or the revolutionary. He's the goat. Right? He's not one of us. Right? In Greek traditions and stories, they understood that the goat was the free-thinking goat. He was the free thinker. In biblical narratives, they celebrate the sheep. And they equate the goat with whom? The devil, Satan. That's how it is in the Bible. But in Indian epics, in the Vedas, it's very different. Rules are not as important as the intent behind your actions. If the intent behind the action is sound, true, honest, then sometimes the rules get shifted. So the intent is more important than the rules in some circumstances. With our stories, who actually follows the rules? You may be surprised. Duryodhana follows the rules when they suit him in the Mahabharata. He picks and chooses according to his whims. And the result is the Battle of Kurukshetra. That's what happens when you operate in whim, fantasy, and self-interest. He is the great antagonist of the Mahabharata. Both Krishna, hero of the Mahabharata, and Ravana, villain of the Ramayana, break the rules. Here's the two rule breakers, right here. Krishna and Ravana in the same sentence. Can you imagine? In Gokul, Krishna brings joy to the residents of Vrindavan with his many pastimes, such as stealing the butter, breaking the rules, breaking the butter pots, feeding the monkeys. It's breaking the rules. He fulfills the deepest desires of the gopis, the cowherd maidens, by luring them to join him in the midnight rasa dance by the light of the full moon in the Sharat season. Fulfilling their deepest, deeply held desires from many, many lifetimes to be with Krishna in such an intimate setting. Do you know how long the rasa dance went on for? Do you remember? One day of Brahma. One day of Brahma in human years is 4,300,000,000 human years. Now you know you must be in the transcendental world, because The brain short circuits when you try to wrap your mind around that. That's how long the Rastadans went on for. I mean, why stop, right? If you have the time in your life, I wish this would never end. You said that? Maybe you don't remember since you didn't say it since you were a child. But we used to say that. Maybe you still say that if you still have your childlike nature. Yeah? It's good to have that. Okay. Krishna is also willing to break the rules when it comes to defeating the enemies of the Pandavas. And who are the examples of that? Jarasandha and Bhishma, took the wheel after him, and the Kauravas. Right? Krishna breaks the rules. Why? Essentially for one reason: to please his devotees. That's what Krishna is motivated by, the loving reciprocal relationship between himself and his devotees. We've been over that numerous times. That's why most of us are sitting here. Ravan breaks the rules, again, like Duryodhana, for his own whims and desires. What does that result in? The burning and destruction of the beautiful city of Lanka. Again, ego-centric actions based on whim and flippant desire. Look what it results in. Destruction, endings, death. So let's expand it out a little bit and say families, family businesses, companies, etc. They need both the Rams and the Krishnas to maintain the welfare of the kingdom or the business. We need the Rams and we need the Krishnas. We need the guys who follow the rules like Ram does, always upholding Dharma, doing the right thing for the right reason. And we need the Krishnas. Okay, we might have to bend this one a little bit here to make this work. Huh? Isn't this not practical? Again, it depends on what? The intent behind it. The motivation behind it. What are we trying to achieve? It's not for your own benefit. That's not the correct motivation. There is no need for Ravanas or Duryodhanas who are only concerned with their own self-interest. So now, what is the relationship between family and business, king and kingdom, CEO and company? Because we can extrapolate these in the same manner, yeah? In the Ramayana, the kingdom of Ayodhya is more important than the family of King Dashrath, which governs the kingdom. They put Ayodhya first. In the Mahabharata, the Kaurava family is far more important than the kingdom of Hastinapur, which they govern. The Kauravas are, at core, resentful, spiteful, insecure, and envious. In the Ramayana, Ram agrees to go into exile. As extreme a thing as, here's the guy who follows the rules, who everybody loves and respects, and he agrees to go into exile. You might say, falsely, unreasonably, in order to do what? To maintain the integrity of the royal family and not to upset the kingdom. It's tremendous self-sacrifice by Ram when you think of it, no? In the Mahabharata, Bhishma renounced the right to the throne and married life. He would have been the heir apparent. He would have been next in line from his father, Shantanu. And Shantanu was wandering around in the forest one day, and he was overwhelmed by this beautiful smell, fragrance of musk. and he followed it till he found its source. Shantanu found a beautiful woman in a hut in the forest, a fisherman's daughter, Satyavati. She's a Shudra. He's a Kshatriya. Satyavati's father said yes to the king, you may marry my daughter, but her firstborn shall be the heir apparent and be king, not your son, who was Bhishma. So Bhishma renounced the throne not for the sake of the kingdom, but to satisfy the lust of his father. And then Bhishma took a very severe vow. That's why he's known as Devavrata. And he vowed to retain celibacy throughout his entire life, which he did. And interestingly, he remained powerful and vital all the way, you know, to the Battle of Kurukshetra. He was one of the, still on the field, he was one of the greatest warriors and one of the greatest heroes. And he was a pretty old guy. I don't know how old he was, but he was an old guy at that time. Krishna was a grandfather during the battle, as I recall. So Bhishma, he was much older. The welfare of the kingdom of Ayodhya plays a key role in all decision-making in the Ramayana. They put the kingdom first. Therefore, the kingdom of Ayodhya remained intact. It didn't crumble, it didn't fall, it didn't burn, it didn't... There was no big uprising, it remained intact. Right? Even through Ram's exile. But not so in the Mahabharata. The kingdom of Hastinapur becomes divided and fought over. I mean, that's really the whole crux of the story. And the kingdom of Indraprasth, which became the Pandavas kingdom when they were ostracized out to scrubland where nothing grew, but they transformed it into this beautiful garden and wonderful city. The kingdom in Indraprasth was gambled away. That's what happened. But placing the kingdom above the family in the Ramayana came at a price. We maintain the kingdom, but the same royal traditions that celebrate the son's obedience of the father's wishes also demanded that a princess of tainted reputation should not become queen. Sita, though pure, her chastity intact, and proven so by entering fire when she was rescued by Ram, and Agni, the fire god himself, carried her out, assuring that her virtue was intact. She had lived for a year in a garden in Lanka, and still, what was best for Ayodhya was not best for the family, the relationship between Ram and Sita, even though she was proven innocent. So what does this tell us? And they were following the rules. This tells us that we do not live in a perfect world, my friends. No matter how hard we try, we can never make it perfect or right or just in every circumstance. Virtually impossible. If it's virtually impossible for them, it's virtually impossible for us. And we know from Bhagavad Gita that every endeavor in this world is covered by some fault or flaw. A case of professional versus personal conflict where professional considerations, Sita's becoming queen, override personal interests, the love between husband and wife, Ram and Sita. This results in Ram's children, whom he didn't even know his wife was pregnant at the time that he exiled her to the forest, to what was it, Vishvamitra's ashram. He didn't even know that he had two sons, Lav and Kush, and nor were they brought up in the palace or in the kingdom where they should have been. They were brought up in the ashram in the forest. Although banishing his wife to the forest due to professional considerations, Ram nonetheless remained true to Sita. So that relationship, even though separated, remained intact, remained true, honest, and faithful. He never took another wife due to his loyalty and his love for Sita. What is true Dharma? Dharma is the journey from animal instinct, lower nature, rakshasa, to human cooperation, manushya, to divine love, deva. Rakshasa, nara or manushya, deva. That is the journey. That is our personal individual journey of evolution as souls in bodies in this world. If we do not evolve and grow, then what are we doing here? We're occupying space. No offense. We must evolve and grow. It is incumbent upon all of us. The animal is supposed to outgrow his lower instincts to be dominant and territorial. We've talked about this in the past. Law of the jungle, the dominant always win. Law of civilization, everybody cooperates. Everybody is protected. Everybody is honored, regarded. Ravan and Duryodhana are alpha males who establish pecking orders and demand obedience to their own self-interest. Ravan and Duryodhana. You'll do what I say because this is what I want, and if I change my mind tomorrow, that's too bad, you'll do that. That's pecking order. You here, you're here, you're here, you're there, I'm right here. They use people. People are pawns in their game. They drag their brothers and sons to their deaths to fulfill their own ends. Did not Ravana do that with his children and his brother Kumbhakarna? Duryodhana, 99 brothers, 99, all dead in the war, to meet their megalomaniacal ends. Dharma is the journey from a Ravan mindset to a Ram mindset. I think it's safe to say that most of the people sitting here in front of me do not have a Ravan mindset. Maybe it flares up every now and then, but I think it's safe to say that's not a big issue for most of you. So, from a Ravan mindset to a Ram mindset, from a Duryodhana mindset to a Krishna mindset. These are our examples. These are the archetypes that are being shown to us in these stories, in these shastras. And for us, personally, Dharma is about establishing a Vishnu mindset. And a Vishnu mindset ensures the flow of wealth, good fortune, and universal compassion. Remember, we talked about this in another class that I had given. If we use the Brahma archetype, Lord Brahma, then we're in a position of control, authority and control. And this is the way it's going to be. Lay down the law. If we're in the Shiva mindset, we can't really be bothered. I really don't want to get involved. I don't want to get my hands dirty and all that stuff. Shiva's detached. So, for those of you that are highly detached, and you're living a monk-like existence, then that's the perfect mindset for you. But for most of us, the best one is the Vishnu mindset. Because when Vishnu is someone who is the preserver, the maintainer, he keeps the whole thing moving along, ticking along, because he's supportive. He's not demanding, he's not neglectful, he's supportive. And he makes the adjustments that are needed to be made so that we can forge ahead and move along. And what does it attract? It attracts, as we said, wealth, good fortune, and universal compassion. Why? Because Vishnu's wife is whom? Lakshmi, goddess of fortune. We want good fortune. We want good events and experiences in our lives. We don't want lack. We don't want bad luck. So the more we enter into and sustain this Vishnu mindset, the greater opportunity or possibility we will have of attracting that to ourselves and living peaceful and fulfilling lives. It depends on our mindset. Mind over matter, depending then on mind governs behavior. Ram upholds the law out of duty, not personal ambition. Where in the Ramayana did you ever see Ram exercise his personal ambition? Except to go rescue Sita. Where? He doesn't. So he always acted out of duty. And because he did that, he loses Sita. That's what it cost him, no? Krishna is a passive participant in all what goes on in the Mahabharata. Krishna is more Krishna Vishnu. He's more trying to iron things out, smooth things out, mediate, resolve conflict, correct? So Krishna is a passive participant in a war not of his own making. It wasn't his actions that started the war or brought the conflict to the precipice of war. Krishna's intent was to transform Yudhishthira from an irresponsible gambler to a responsible ruler. Effectively, Yudhishthira, who is a great soul and a great king, in a moment of weakness, when he was challenged to participate in a gambling match, which by rule, by code, by Kshatriya code, you can't say no if you're challenged. But he got carried away in all that. And in a moment or two of weakness, he bet the whole kingdom. In fact, even bet Draupadi. And he lost, and we also know that the whole match was crooked anyway because Shakuni was at the dice. But still, so there's Yudhishthira, one of the most noble of souls, of kings, in a moment of weakness. Lost the whole kingdom. Got banished into exile, him and his brothers and their mother. Yeah, Kunti also. So, is it possible we may be struck by a moment of weakness, my friends? Oh, I think so. On occasion. You know, when you're, I better not do this. Yeah, you should do it. No, I think you should do it. No, I can't. You know, the whole thing could just blow up my face. Well, we could try. Anyway, you never know. Angel devil on your shoulder. So that's what Krishna was trying to do. Krishna pays the price for his participation as the mediator in the conflict between the Kauravas and the Pandavas. How so? His family is cursed by Gandhari, wife of Dhritarashtra, mother of all of the Kaurava sons who were killed in the battle. Yeah? After the 18-day battle, Krishna meets Gandhari in anger and grief over the death of her sons and the Kaurava soldiers. Gandhari curses Krishna with the destruction of the Yadu dynasty, his family, in a manner similar to the death of her own sons, through internecine conflict. Is that what happened to them? They killed each other. And I think, if I recall, they had been drinking. Were they not drinking?
Yeah, rice wine.
Pardon?
Wine made from rice.
Rice wine. There you go. See, they had it before the Japanese did. He shows you. It's older than the Japanese. She blames Krishna for his inaction. Yeah, but you didn't do anything to stop it. She accuses him. And believes that he could have prevented the war and the slaughter of hundreds of millions of people who died in the war. Now, Krishna could have neutralized this curse. But did he? No. He accepted it. He accepted the curse. And he explained to her how he had tried many times to mediate the peace. And how Duryodhana, her son, and Dhritarashtra, her husband, refused him. Yet she blamed Krishna. He also explained how Duryodhana and the Kauravas had tried many times in the past to kill the Pandavas. House of Lakh, many, many times, a few times. With Bhima in the river and tried to drown. Right? Interestingly, and of course, you know, the Yadavas, the Yadu dynasty, they had this fight, they were all killed off. And Krishna left the planet about that time, right? Now here's an interesting footnote. Where was Gandhari from? The kingdom of Gandhar. What is that modern day? Afghanistan. What's happening in Afghanistan, I ask you, all these years? War. I know you're going to say, oh, come on, that was 5,000 years ago. I'm just telling you. I'm only mentioning there's still war going on in the kingdom of Gandhar, right? I know there's many nice people there, but here you go. What is the role of a leader in the family, in business, in a kingdom, whatever? What is the role of the leader? The leader, or the karta, his role is, or her role, is the yajaman. One who offers the sacrifice. One who establishes sacrifice. One who does things on behalf of sacrifice for a higher result. The yajaman offers everything to Krishna. By offering everything to Krishna, it removes the ego and the self-interest and acknowledges that God, who created everything, is the owner of everything, needs to be appeased or recognized as such. And this ultimately is the best benefit for whom? For himself, the yajaman, for the family, for the kingdom, for the business. Correct? He is not, the yajman, or the true leader, is not the one who establishes the pecking order and demands obedience unreasonably. And what is the yajman's role? This is a nice point here. The yajman, or true leader's role, is to increase the sensitivity, the sense of duty and responsibility for the family, the staff, or the employees. To increase the sensitivity and the sense of duty and responsibility. That's the role of the true leader. I don't care what you're in charge of. Many of you are in charge of all kinds of things. Some things just small and some things great. Doesn't matter. It applies to all. How does he do this? Effectively, he must increase his own sensitivity to the needs of his family, his staff, his employees. We have to become thoughtful. We have to become perceptive. We have to open up and be approachable. We have to pay attention. We can't steamroll ahead. The growth of the family, the staff, or the employees will mirror whose growth? The growth of the leader. If you as a leader aren't growing, aren't evolving, then how do you expect your family, your company, your business concern, whatever you're doing, how do you expect that to grow and evolve? When you're not paying attention, or, in fairness, you're stuck. We get stuck. We're humans. We all get stuck from time to time. And we stay stuck for a while, okay. But you cannot remain stuck. You need to shift that. If you cannot shift it on your own, then you need to seek help or counsel or something to help you shift that, no? The evolution doesn't stop. You know, I always smile when people say, you say, well, why don't you do this, or why don't you go and take this course or this class? Oh, I'm too old for that. Well, you're breathing the air, aren't you? You're walking around. I'm too old. You're never too old. Oh, I'm too old to grow and evolve. Oh, I'm just here in the chair. It rocks. Oh, yeah. No, no, no. And you're not paying attention. You do that to the day you die. You're never too old to learn. I saw a story in the newspaper of a woman 98 years old. She got her a university degree. She had her cap and gown on. Big smile on her face, you know. It's great, you know. She was happy. I guess it was a lifelong dream of hers. She kept growing. The natural leader is not necessarily the oldest in the family. Oh, we're going to give it to the oldest one. Yeah, are you sure? Is that a good idea? It's not necessarily the oldest, nor is it necessarily the CEO. Or the CFO, or the COO, or who's ever managing things. Not necessarily. Natural leaders do not always wear a crown, or are they in positions as CEO or owner. Nor are they the oldest sibling. Ram was the oldest. Krishna was not. The natural leader is the person who most effectively understands people and their potential, and who encourages them to grow and develop according to their own unique nature or dharma. Did you get that? That's the natural leader. The one who empowers others, who sees them truly and knows who they are and knows what's needed to give them that little gentle push to go to the next step, to achieve the next achievement. Once Lakshman in the Ramayana, he complained to Ram. He says, I always have to obey you because you're the oldest. Ram replied, don't worry. In our next life on earth, you'll be the oldest, but you'll still agree with me because all my actions will be based in dharma. So this Krishna and Balaram, oh, don't worry, you'll be the oldest next life, but I'll still be running things. What causes the disruption of the family, kingdom, or business? Disruption of the family, kingdom, or business happens when the leader makes a terrible decision or a bad mistake. What happens? Trust collapses. And what rushes in? Fear and insecurity. That's what happens. When trust is lost and dharma is abandoned, then we get the me versus him. Every man for himself, or this one sees it this way, this one sees it this way, and we have a conflict. They take sides, they stop cooperating. That's why the true leader always holds God in the center of all actions. That's why we practice bhakti yoga. Everything we do is an offering. We do it with Krishna's pleasure, Krishna's satisfaction in mind, for the reasons I've already given. Here we are walking around on earth. That's your horizontal line. Often people think this is the competition theory. You know, I've got to get mine before he gets his. There's only so much to go around, and I need to get mine. If he gets it, there won't be enough for me. I'll lose out. Right? So that's what you get when we're walking around this horizontal plane. This man and this man, for example. We put God in the middle. Now we have the triangle, where we have the vertical line coming down, the divine energy, the human energy on the horizontal plane, the divine energy on the vertical plane. What do we have there? The cross. That's where they get the symbol of the cross. That's what it means. It's incumbent to always have God in the center. Then, if we sincerely try to do that, there's much less of a chance that we will be victimized by our own ego or that of somebody else. So, this is what we need to keep in the center: our consciousness of God and our service to Him for the greater good. Everything we do is not just for ourselves. It is, if you're following Dharma, you are acting in harmony with your nature, satisfying your own nature, benefiting yourself, and making a contribution to the world around you. Win-win. So, what's an example? Dasharatha gave the throne to Bharata and exiled Ram. However, Bharata did not turn into a Duryodhana, did he? And act for his own self-interest, because both he and Ram are true leaders. They're yajamans, natural leaders. This held the family together until the difficulties had passed. So the growth of the family, the kingdom, or business depends on the growth of the leader. Okay, identity. In the Ramayana, Ram does not consider himself to be the entitled owner of the kingdom of Ayodhya. He does not derive his own identity from the kingdom. He does not completely identify with being the king of Ayodhya. Correct? He was ready to step into that role as the crown prince, becoming the king, and then it all fell through. He got on top of it, he got exiled. But it didn't confuse him, did it? Seemingly, it did not confuse him. Because his identity was not invested in it. It's a very important point. Therefore, he was able to give it up with ease when exile was imposed upon him. Therefore, Ayodhya is not the territory from which he derives his own self-image. Unfortunately, most entrepreneurs, professionals, and CEOs derive their identity from their job, career, position, or business ownership. How many times do we tell people what we do before they even ask us? Hi, how are you? What's your name? My name's so-and-so. And then you tell them what you do. Now, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. It's very common. But see, this is you, your identity, and this is you as your position or your status, or you as the manager or the owner or whatever you may be. These are two different things. Some people have difficulty separating their own identity from their professional status or function. The typical rules or guidelines of corporate governance will never create a Ram or a Krishna or an enlightened leader. Because any set of rules and guidelines that are attached to businesses, companies, and corporations, my friends, I don't read them all, but I have a lot of those people that are clients of mine, they do not lead to enlightened leadership. That's not what it's about. It's about profit. In the modern age, it's about profit. It's about how much work or product you generate and how much profit, and can you have it done by tomorrow? Tomorrow, I'll have to pull an all-nighter. That's good. Why don't you do that? I'll see you bright and early in the morning, especially you guys in tech business. We know that one. I get hundreds of clients in Silicon Valley. I go there about once a year and pick a few of them up and dust them off. Tell them to go home and have a sleep. So the rules of corporations and businesses, they have their rules for reasons, but those are not the rules to live by. What will make you become an enlightened leader then in that case? To mature emotionally, to heal psychologically, and to grow spiritually. If you do those things, you will become a natural leader and an enlightened leader. Thank you for your kind attention. Hare Krishna. Questions?
Thank you very much for a very enlightening, enlightening class.
Thank you, Boom.
When you spoke about the proper utilization and application of Dharma according to time, place, and circumstance, an example came to my mind. I thought it would be nice to hear your elucidate on it. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, there's a pastime where, the eighth canto, where Vishnu, he advises the demigods to make a truce with the demons at a particular time. And he uses the analogy of the snake and a mouse in a basket. And he says, the snake and the mouse are caught in the basket, And then he says, but the snake wants to eat the mouse. But if the snake eats the mouse,
he won't get out of the basket.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he has to make a deal with the, so that the snake, the mouse will chew a hole in the basket, and then they both, ideally, both ideally can leave the basket and escape.
Yeah.
So I've meditated on this in different situations in my life. I think sometimes I have to go with the flow of the negative energy at this moment in time.
So you're, more often than not, you're the mouse in these situations?
Well, I like to think of myself. Sometimes.
Go ahead.
So, well, yeah, seeing the situation is there, and I think I want to do the right thing, but I'm in a situation where there's less than virtuous energy around me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm thinking, if I fight against this less than virtuous energy, it's going to cause more disturbance.
Can do.
If I go with it for the time being, and then when the time then I can escape when the virtuosity becomes more apparent and more prominent.
Yeah.
So I'd like to hear you say some words about that dynamic.
Well, I can say a couple words about that. When you live in an ashram, which I did for a mere 5 years of my life in Krishna ashram, you are insulated and you are protected and you are following a program, spiritual program, as you know, getting up 3 o'clock in the morning, going to Mangalarti at 4 a.m., chanting japa, doing prayers, mantra, meditation, serving, service. It's and then you really, and you keep doing that, it just generates this powerful, powerful force, spiritual force. And it's very exciting. It's very dynamic. It shifts your consciousness very quickly. And inspiring, and you really feel that connection to Krishna. That was my experience, and I know it's been true for many. But when you go out into the world, all you got to do is how did you phrase it again? Go less than virtuous. I love it. Just walk out on the street, and you'll get less than virtuous. Okay, that's all you got to do. You got to just take a few steps down the stairs. You'll get less than virtuous. We live in this world, unless we're in the ashram, we're living in a less than virtuous world. The stronger our sadhana and our spiritual practice is, the more we are protected from those circumstances, but it's not ideal, it's not perfect, it's not a perfect world. And we can come into that less than virtuous temptations, etc. It's virtually impossible not to be affected or contaminated when you're in the material world. It's virtually impossible. If you can do it successfully and never be touched by it, I'm in great admiration of you. But yeah, what you said is true. Sometimes you just have to adapt and roll with it. One thing we don't want to do, we want always to give people respect. And many people you may meet will not have as high a consciousness or as great a spiritual awareness as you do. But that doesn't mean we respect them any less. We always offer them respect and kindness and understanding. That is our duty, firstly, as human beings. And if there's an opening or an opportunity to inspire them in some way and help them to see things differently from a higher perspective, then we should take that opportunity. As far as banging them over the head with your belief in whatever you believe in spiritually, you know, or forcing it upon somebody who's not interested, I've never been in favor of that myself. It's never been my approach. You know, because there's enough people out there that will come and that are interested. Or they may not be interested today, but let them go through a couple more things in life and watch what happens. They'll become interested. So, you know, again, desha kala patra, time, place, and circumstance. I think you're doing the right thing. You wait for the right moment, you know. Moments have within them, according to astrology, it's a muhurta. Each moment in time has within it the seeds of its fructification. Which means that when you plant the seed at the right time, it will fructify, it will
sprout,
it will grow, and it will at some point deliver flowers, fruits, if it's planted at the right time. If we plant it at the wrong time, it may not work. So I think with that in mind alone, we choose these moments carefully and make ourselves available. Because why exchange information with someone on whom it's falling on deaf ears? They're not listening. They're not listening. They're not able to hear you. You know. So the mouse ate through the basket, and
there's many different endings.
Yeah, I know. I know. There's several endings to that.
But if the snake eats it, then he might be too fat to get out of the basket also. If he eats the mouse and tries to escape after the mouse.
Oh, yeah, right. That's good. Yeah, I love that story.
Vishnu, I don't think the story goes that the demigods and the demons, they work together. They turn the ocean of...
Yes, I know.
So the demigods, who are the proverbial snake, they got the nectar, and then Vishnu came, and he took the nectar in the form of Mohini Murti.
Yeah.
And he gave it to the mice or the demigods, and they became immortal, and then they were able to defeat the demigods.
Yeah, except for Rahu. Rahu, his head survived. Jai Hari Krishna. Thank you.